Chapter 2. As the dancers poured out of the hall, Frome, drawing back against the projecting storm door, watched the segregation of the grotesquely muffled groups, in which a moving lantern ray now and then lit up a face flushed with food and dancing. The villagers, being afoot, were the first to climb the slope to the main street, while the country neighbors packed themselves more slowly into the sleighs under the shed. "Ain't you riding, Maddie?" a woman's voice called back from the throng about the shed, and Ethan's heart gave a jump. From where he stood, he could not see the persons coming out of the hall till they had advanced a few steps beyond the wooden sides of the storm door, but through its cracks he heard a clear voice answer, "Mercy, no, not on such a night." She was there then, close to him, only a thin board between them. In another moment she would step forth into the night, and his eyes, accustomed to the obscurity, would discern her as clearly as though she stood in daylight. A wave of shyness pulled him back into the dark angle of the wall, and he stood there in silence instead of making his presence known to her. It had been one of the wonders of their intercourse that from the first she, the quicker, finer, more expressive, instead of crushing him by the contrast, had given him something of her own ease and freedom. But now he felt as heavy and loutish as in his student days when he had tried to jolly the Worcester girls at a picnic. He hung back, and she came out alone and paused within a few yards of him. She was almost the last to leave the hall, and she stood looking uncertainly about her, as if wondering why he did not show himself. Then a man's figure approached, coming so close to her that under their formless wrappings they seemed merged in one dim outline. "Gentleman friend gone back on you? Say, Math, that's tough. No, I wouldn't be mean enough to tell the other girls. I ain't as low down as that." How Frome hated his cheap banter. "But look a-here, ain't it lucky I got the old man's cutter down there waiting for us?" Frome heard the girl's voice, gaily incredulous. "What on earth's your father's cutter doing down there?" "Why, waiting for me to take a ride. I got the roan colt, too. I kinder knew I'd want to take a ride tonight." Edie, in his triumph, tried to put a sentimental note into his bragging voice. The girl seemed to waver, and Frome saw her twirl the end of her scarf irresolutely about her fingers. Not for the world would he have made a sign to her, though it seemed to him that his life hung on her next gesture. "Hold on a minute while I unhitch the colt," Dennis called to her, springing toward the shed. She stood perfectly still, looking after him in an attitude of tranquil expectancy, torturing to the hidden watcher. Frome noticed that she no longer turned her head from side to side, as though peering through the night for another figure. She let Dennis Edie lead out the horse, climb into the cutter, and fling back the bearskin to make room for her at his side. Then, with a swift motion of flight, she turned about and darted up the slope toward the front of the church. "Goodbye. Hope you'll have a lovely ride," she called back to him over her shoulder. Dennis laughed and gave the horse a cut that brought him quickly abreast of her retreating figure. "Come along, get in quick, it's as slippery as thunder on this turn," he cried, leaning over to reach out a hand to her. She laughed back at him. "Good night, I'm not getting in." By this time they had passed beyond Frome's earshot, and he could only follow the shadowy pantomime of their silhouettes as they continued to move along the crest of the slope above him. He saw Edie, after a moment, jump from the cutter and go toward the girl with the reins over one arm. The other he tried to slip through hers, but she eluded him nimbly, and Frome's heart, which had swung out over a black void, trembled back to safety. A moment later he heard the jingle of departing sleigh bells, and discerned a figure advancing along toward the empty expanse of snow before the church. In the black shade of the Varnum spruces, he caught up with her, and she turned with a quick, "Oh!" "Think I'd forgotten you, Matt?" he asked with sheepish glee. She answered seriously, "I thought maybe you couldn't come back for me."
"Couldn't? What on earth could stop me?"
"I knew Zena wasn't feeling any too good today."
"Oh, she's in bed long ago. He paused, a question struggling in him. Then you meant to walk home all alone? Oh, I ain't afraid, she laughed. They stood together in the gloom of the spruces, an empty world glimmering about them, wide and gray under the stars. He brought his question out. If you thought I hadn't come, why didn't you ride back with Dennis Eady?
Why, where were you? How did you know? I never saw you.
Her wonder and his laughter ran together like spring rills in a thaw. Ethan had the sense of having done something arch and ingenious. To prolong the effect, he groped for a dazzling phrase and brought out in a growl of rapture, "Come along." He slipped an arm through hers, as Edie had done, and fancied it was faintly pressed against her side. But neither of them moved. It was so dark under the spruces that he could barely see the shape of her head against his shoulder. He longed to stoop his cheek and rub it against her scarf. He would have liked to stand there with her all night in the blackness. She moved forward a step or two, and then paused again above the dip of the Corbury Road. Its icy slope, scored by innumerable runners, looked like a mirror scratched by travelers at an inn. "There was a whole lot of them coasting before the moon set," she said.
"Would you like to come in and coast with them some night?" he asked.
"Oh, would you, Ethan? It would be lovely."
"We'll come tomorrow if there's a moon."
She lingered, pressing closer to his side.
"Ned Hale and Ruth Varnum came just as near running into the big elm at the bottom. We were all sure they were killed."
Her shiver ran down his arm.
"Wouldn't it have been too awful? They're so happy."
"Oh, Ned ain't much at steering. I guess I can take you down all right," he said disdainfully. He was aware that he was talking big, like Dennis Eady, but his reaction of joy had unsteadied him, and the inflection with which she had said of the engaged couple, "They're so happy," made the words sound as if she had been thinking of herself and him. "The elm is dangerous, though. It ought to be cut down," she insisted. "Would you be afraid of it with me?"
"I told you I ain't the kind to be afraid," she tossed back, almost indifferently, and suddenly she began to walk on with a rapid step. These alterations of mood were the despair and joy of Ethan Frome. The motions of her mind were as incalculable as the flit of a bird in the branches. The fact that he had no right to show his feelings and thus provoke the expression of hers made him attach a fantastic importance to every change in her look and tone. Now he thought she understood him and feared. Now he was sure she did not and despaired. Tonight the pressure of accumulated misgivings sent the scale drooping toward despair, and her indifference was the more chilling after the flush of joy into which she had plunged him by dismissing Dennis Eady. He mounted Schoolhouse Hill at her side and walked on in silence till they reached the lane leading to the sawmill. Then the need of some definite assurance grew too strong for him.
"You'd have found me right off if you hadn't gone back to have that last reel with Dennis," he brought out awkwardly. He could not pronounce the name without a stiffening of the muscles of his throat.
"Why, Ethan, how could I tell you were there?"
"I suppose what folks say is true," he jerked out at her instead of answering.
She stopped short, and he felt, in the darkness, that her face was lifted quickly to his.
"Why? What do folks say?"
"It's natural enough you should be leaving us," he floundered on, following his thought.
"Is that what they say?"
she mocked back at him, then with a sudden drop of her sweet treble.
"You mean that Zena ain't suited with me anymore?" she faltered.
Their arms had slipped apart, and they stood motionless, each seeking to distinguish the other's face.
"I know I ain't anything like as smart as I ought to be," he went on, while he struggled vainly for expression.
There's lots of things a hired girl could do that come awkward to me still, and I haven't got much strength in my arms. But if she'd only tell me, I'd try. You know, she hardly ever says anything, and sometimes I can see she ain't suited, and yet I don't know why. She turned on him with a sudden flash of indignation. You'd ought to tell me, Ethan Frome, you'd ought to, unless you want me to go too. Unless he wanted her to go too. The cry was balm to his raw wound. The iron heaven seemed to melt and rain down sweetness. Again he struggled for the all-expressive word, and again his arm in hers found only a deep, come along. They walked on in silence through the blackness of the hemlock-shaded lane, where Ethan's sawmill gloomed through the night, and out again into the comparative clearness of the fields. On the farther side of the hemlock belt, the open country rolled away before them, gray and lonely under the stars. Sometimes their way led them under the shade of an overhanging bank or through the thin obscurity of a clump of leafless trees. Here and there a farmhouse stood far back among the fields, mute and cold as a gravestone. The night was so still that they heard the frozen snow crackle under their feet. The crash of a loaded branch falling far off in the woods reverberated like a musket shot, and once a fox barked, and Maddie shrank closer to Ethan and quickened her steps. At length they sighted the group of larches at Ethan's gate, and as they drew near it, the sense that the walk was over brought back his words. "Then you don't want to leave us, Matt?" He had to stoop his head to catch her stifled whisper. "Where'd I go if I did?" The answer sent a pang through him, but the tone suffused him with joy. He forgot what Elsie had meant to say and pressed her against him so closely that he seemed to feel her warmth in his veins. "You ain't crying, are you, Matt?"
"No, of course I'm not," she quavered.
They turned in at the gate and passed under the shaded knoll where, enclosed in a low fence, the Frome gravestone slanted at crazy angles through the snow. Ethan looked at them curiously. For years that quiet company had mocked his restlessness, his desire for change and freedom. "We never got away. How should you?" seemed to be written on every headstone, and whenever he went in or out of his gate he thought with a shiver, "I shall just go on living here till I join them." But now all desire for change had vanished, and the sight of the little enclosure gave him a warm sense of continuance and stability. "I guess we'll never let you go, Matt," he whispered, as though even the dead lovers once must conspire with him to keep her. And brushing by the graves, he thought, "We'll always go on living here together, and someday she'll lie there beside me." He let the vision possess him as they climbed the hill to the house. He was never so happy with her as when he abandoned himself to these dreams. Halfway up the slope, Maddie stumbled against some unseen obstruction and clutched his sleeve to steady herself. The wave of warmth that went through him was like the prolongation of his vision. For the first time, he stole his arms about her, and she did not resist. They walked on as if they were floating on a summer stream. Zena always went to bed as soon as she had had her supper, and the shutterless windows of the house were dark. A dead cucumber vine dangled from the porch like the crepe streamer tied to the door for a death, and the thought flashed through Ethan's brain, if it was there for Zena. Then he had a distinct sight of his wife lying in their bedroom asleep, her mouth slightly open, her false teeth in a tumbler by the bed. They walked around to the back of the house between the rigid gooseberry bushes. It was Zena's habit, when they came back late from the village, to leave the key of the kitchen door under the mat. Ethan stood before the door, his head heavy with his dreams, his arms still about Maddie. "Matt," he began, not knowing what he meant to say. She slipped out of his hold without speaking, and he stooped down and felt for the key. It's not there, he said, straightening himself with a start. They strained their eyes at each other through the icy darkness. Such a thing had never happened before.
Maybe she's forgotten it, Maddie said in a tremulous whisper, but both of them knew that it was not like Xena to forget.
It might have fallen off into the snow, Maddie continued after a pause during which they had stood intently listening.
It must have been pushed off then, he rejoined in the same tone. Another wild thought tore through him. What if tramps had been there? What if...
Again he listened, fancying he heard a distant sound in the house. Then he felt in his pocket for a match and, kneeling down, passed its light slowly over the rough edges of snow about the doorstep. He was still kneeling when his eyes, on a level with the lower panel of the door, caught a faint ray beneath it. Who could be stirring in that silent house? He heard a step on the stairs, and again for an instant the thought of tramps tore through him. Then the door opened, and he saw his wife. Against the dark background of the kitchen, she stood up tall and angular, one hand drawing a quilted counterpane to her flat breast, while the other held a lamp. The light, on a level with her chin, drew out of the darkness her puckered throat and the projecting wrist of the hand that clutched the quilt, and deepened fantastically the hollows and prominences of her high-boned face under its ring of crimping pins. To Ethan, still in the rosy haze of his hour with Maddie, the sight came with the intense precision of the last dream before waking. He felt as if he had never before known what his wife looked like. She drew aside without speaking, and Maddie and Ethan passed into the kitchen, which had the deadly chill of a vault after the dry cold of the night.
"Guess you forgot about us, Xena," Ethan joked, stamping the snow from his boots.
"No, I just felt so mean I couldn't sleep." Maddie came forward, unwinding her wraps, the color of the cherry scarf in her fresh lips and cheeks.
"I'm so sorry, Xena. Isn't there anything I can do?"
"No, there's nothing." Xena turned away from her. "You might have shook off that snow outside," she said to her husband. She walked out of the kitchen ahead of them, and pausing in the hall, raised the lamp at arm's length as if to light them up the stairs. Ethan paused also, affecting to fumble for the peg on which he hung his coat and cap. The doors of the two bedrooms faced each other across the narrow upper landing, and tonight it was peculiarly repugnant to him that Maddie should see him follow Xena.
"I guess I won't come up yet a while," he said, turning as if to go back to the kitchen.
Xena stopped short and looked at him.
"For the land's sake, what are you going to do down here?"
"I've got the mill accounts to go over." She continued to stare at him, the flame of the unshaded lamp bringing out with microscopic cruelty the fretful lines of her face.
"At this time of night, you'll catch your death. The fire's out long ago."
Without answering, he moved away toward the kitchen. As he did so, his glance crossed Maddie's, and he fancied that a fugitive warning gleamed through her lashes. The next moment they sank to her flushed cheeks, and she began to mount the stairs ahead of Xena.
"That's so. It is powerful cold down here," Ethan assented.
And with lowered head he went up in his wife's wake and followed her across the threshold of their room. Chapter 3. There was some hauling to be done at the lower end of the woodlot, and Ethan was out early the next day. The winter morning was as clear as crystal. The sunrise burned red in a pure sky. The shadows on the rim of the woodlot were darkly blue, and beyond the white and scintillating fields, patches of far-off forest hung like smoke. It was in the early morning stillness, when his muscles were swinging to their familiar task, and his lungs expanding with long drafts of mountain air, that Ethan did his clearest thinking. He and Zena had not exchanged a word after the door of their room had closed on them. She had measured out some drops from a medicine bottle on a chair by the bed, and after swallowing them and wrapping her head in a piece of yellow flannel, had lain down with her face turned away. Ethan undressed hurriedly and blew out the light so that he should not see her when he took his place at her side. As he lay there, he could hear Maddie moving about in her room, and her candle, sending its small ray across the landing, drew a scarcely perceptible line of light under his door. He kept his eyes fixed on the light till it vanished. Then the room grew perfectly black, and not a sound was audible but Zena's asthmatic breathing. Ethan felt confusedly that there were many things he ought to think about, but through his tingling veins and tired brain only one sensation throbbed, the warmth of Maddie's shoulder against his. Why had he not kissed her when he held her there? A few hours earlier he would not have asked himself the question. Even a few minutes earlier, when they had stood alone outside the house, he would not have dared to think of kissing her. But since he had seen her lips in the lamplight, he felt that they were his. Now, in the bright morning air, her face was still before him. It was part of the sun's red, of the pure glitter on the snow. How the girl had changed since she had come to Starkfield. He remembered what a colorless slip of a thing she had looked the day he had met her at the station. And all the first winter, how she had shivered with cold when the northerly gales shook the thin clapboards and the snow beat like hail against the loose-hung windows. He had been afraid that she would hate the hard life, the cold and loneliness, but not a sign of discontent escaped her. Zena took the view that Maddie was bound to make the best of Starkfield, since she hadn't any other place to go, but this did not strike Ethan as conclusive. Zena, at any rate, did not apply the principle in her own case. He felt all the more sorry for the girl because misfortune had, in a sense, indentured her to them. Maddie Silver was the daughter of a cousin of Zenobia Frome's, who had inflamed his clan with mingled sentiments of envy and admiration by descending from the hills to Connecticut, where he had married a Stamford girl and succeeded to her father's thriving drug business. Unhappily, Orrin Silver, a man of far-reaching aims, had died too soon to prove that the end justifies the means. His accounts revealed merely what the means had been, and these were such that it was fortunate for his wife and daughter that his books were examined only after his impressive funeral. His wife died of the disclosure, and Maddie, at 20, was left alone to make her way on the $50 obtained from the sale of her piano. For this purpose, her equipment, though varied, was inadequate. She could trim a hat, make molasses candy, recite Curfew Shall Not Ring Tonight, and play The Lost Chord and a Potpourri from Carmen. When she tried to extend the field of her activities in the direction of stenography and bookkeeping, her health broke down, and 6 months on her feet behind the counter of a department store did not tend to restore it. Her nearest relations had been induced to place their savings in her father's hands, and though after his death they ungrudgingly acquitted themselves of the Christian duty of returning good for evil by giving his daughter all the advice at their disposal, they could hardly be expected to supplement it by material aid. But when Zenobia's doctor recommended her looking about for someone to help her with the housework, the clan instantly saw the chance of exacting a compensation from Maddie. Zenobia, though doubtful of the girl's efficiency, was tempted by the freedom to find fault without much risk of losing her, and so Maddie came to Starkfield. Zenobia's fault-finding was of the silent kind, but not the less penetrating for that. During the first months, Ethan alternately burned with the desire to see Maddie defy her, and trembled with fear of the result. Then the situation grew less strained. The pure air and the long summer hours in the open gave back life and elasticity to Maddie, and Zena, with more leisure to devote to her complex ailments, grew less watchful of the girl's emissions, so that Ethan, struggling on under the burden of his barren farm and failing sawmill, could at least imagine that peace reigned in his house. There was, really, even now, no tangible evidence to the contrary, but since the previous night a vague dread had hung on his skyline. It was formed of Zena's obstinate silence, of Maddie's sudden look of warning, of the memory of just such fleeting imperceptible signs as those which told him, on certain stainless mornings, that before night there would be rain. His dread was so strong that, manlike, he sought to postpone certainty. The hauling was not over till midday, and as the lumber was to be delivered to Andrew Hale, the Starkfield builder, it was really easier for Ethan to send Jotham Powell, the hired man, back to the farm on foot and drive the load down to the village himself. He had scrambled up on the logs and was sitting astride of them, close over his shaggy grays, when, coming between him and their streaming necks, he had a vision of the warning look that Maddie had given him the night before. "If there's going to be any trouble, I want to be there," was his vague reflection, as he threw to Jotham the unexpected order to unhitch the team and lead them back to the barn. It was a slow trudge home through the heavy fields, and when the two men entered the kitchen, Maddie was lifting the coffee from the stove and Zena was already at the table. Her husband stopped short at sight of her. Instead of her usual calico wrapper and knitted shawl, she wore her best dress of brown merino, and above her thin strands of hair, which still preserved the tight undulations of the crimping pins, rose a hard perpendicular bonnet, as to which Ethan's clearest notion was that he had to pay $5 for it at the Bettsbridge Emporium. On the floor beside her stood his old valise and a bandbox wrapped in newspapers.
"Why, where are you going, Zena?" he exclaimed.
"I've got my shooting pain so bad that I'm going over to Bettsbridge to spend the night with Aunt Martha Pierce and see that new doctor," she answered in a matter-of-fact tone, as if she had said she was going into the storeroom to take a look at the preserves or up to the attic to go over the blankets. In spite of her sedentary habits, such abrupt decisions were not without precedent in Zena's history. Twice or thrice before she had suddenly packed Ethan's valise and started off to Bettsbridge, or even Springfield, to seek the advice of some new doctor, and her husband had grown to dread these expeditions because of their cost. Zena always came back laden with expensive remedies, and her last visit to Springfield had been commemorated by her paying $20 for an electric battery of which she had never been able to learn the use. But for the moment his sense of relief was so great as to preclude all other feelings. He had now no doubt that Zena had spoken the truth in saying the night before that she had sat up because she felt too mean to sleep. Her abrupt resolve to seek medical advice showed that, as usual, she was wholly absorbed in her health. As if expecting a protest, she continued plaintively, "If you're too busy with the hauling, I presume you can let Jotham Powell drive me over with the sorrel in time to catch the train at the flats." Her husband hardly heard what she was saying. During the winter months, there was no stage between Starkfield and Bettsbridge, and the trains which stopped at Corbury Flats were slow and infrequent. A rapid calculation showed Ethan that Zena could not be back at the farm before the following evening. "If I'd supposed you'd have made any objection to Jotham Powell's driving me over," she began again, as though his silence had implied refusal. On the brink of departure she was always seized with a flux of words. "All I know is," she continued, "I can't go on the way I am much longer. The pains are clear way down to my ankles now, or I'd have walked into Starkfield on my own feet sooner and put you out, and asked Michael Eady to let me ride over on his wagon to the flats when he sends to meet the train that brings his groceries. I'd have had 2 hours to wait in the station, but I'd have sooner done it, even with this cold, than to have you say, course Jotham will drive you over, Ethan roused himself to answer. He became suddenly conscious that he was looking at Maddie while Zena talked to him, and with an effort he turned his eyes to his wife. She sat opposite the window, and the pale light reflected from the banks of snow made her face look more than usually drawn and bloodless, sharpened the three parallel creases between ear and cheek, and drew querulous lines from her thin nose to the corners of her mouth. Though she was but 7 years her husband's senior, and he was only 28, she was already an old woman. Ethan tried to say something befitting the occasion, but there was only one thought in his mind. The fact that, for the first time since Maddie had come to live with them, Zena was to be away for a night. He wondered if the girl were thinking of it, too. He knew that Zena must be wondering why he did not offer to drive her to the flats and let Jotham Powell take the lumber to Starkfield, and at first he could not think of a pretext for not doing so. Then he said, "I'd take you over myself, only I've got to collect the cash for the lumber." As soon as the words were spoken, he regretted them, not only because they were untrue, there being no prospect of his receiving cash payment from Hale, but also because he knew from experience the imprudence of letting Zena think he was in funds on the eve of one of her therapeutic excursions. At the moment, however, his one desire was to avoid the long drive with her behind the ancient sorrel who never went out of a walk. Zena made no reply. She did not seem to hear what he had said. She had already pushed her plate aside and was measuring out a draught from a large bottle at her elbow. "It ain't done me a speck of good, but I guess I might as well use it up," she remarked, adding as she pushed the empty bottle toward Maddie. "If you can get the taste out, it'll do for pickles." Chapter 4. As soon as his wife had driven off, Ethan took his coat and cap from the peg. Maddie was washing up the dishes, humming one of the dance tunes of the night before. He said, "So long, Matt," and she answered gaily, "So long, Ethan," and that was all. It was warm and bright in the kitchen. The sun slanted through the south window on the girl's moving figure, on the cat dozing in a chair, and on the geraniums brought in from the doorway where Ethan had planted them in the summer to make a garden for Maddie. He would have liked to linger on, watching her tidy up and then settle down to her sewing, but he wanted still more to get the hauling done and be back at the farm before night. All the way down to the village, he continued to think of his return to Maddie. The kitchen was a poor place, not spruce and shining as his mother had kept it in his boyhood, but it was surprising what a homelike look the mere fact of Zena's absence gave it. And he pictured what it would be like that evening when he and Maddie were there after supper. For the first time they would be alone together indoors, and they would sit there, one on each side of the stove like a married couple, he in his stocking feet and smoking his pipe, she laughing and talking in that funny way she had, which was always as new to him as if he had never heard her before. The sweetness of the picture, and the relief of knowing that his fears of trouble with Zena were unfounded, sent up his spirits with a rush, and he, who was usually so silent, whistled and sang aloud as he drove through the snowy fields. There was in him a slumbering spark of sociability, which the long Starkfield winters had not yet extinguished. By nature grave and inarticulate, he admired recklessness and gaiety in others, and was warmed to the marrow by friendly human intercourse. At Worcester, though he had the name of keeping to himself and not being much of a hand at a good time, he had secretly gloried in being clapped on the back and hailed as Old Eath or Old Stiff, and the cessation of such familiarities had increased the chill of his return to Starkfield. There the silence had deepened about him year by year. Left alone after his father's accident to carry the burden of farm and mill, he had had no time for convivial loiterings in the village. And when his mother fell ill, the loneliness of the house grew more oppressive than that of the fields.
His mother had been a talker in her day, but after her trouble, the sound of her voice was seldom heard, though she had not lost the power of speech. Sometimes, in the long winter evenings, when in desperation her son asked her why she didn't say something, she would lift a finger and answer, "Because I'm listening." And on stormy nights, when the loud wind was about the house, she would complain if he spoke to her. "They're talking so out there that I can't hear you." It was only when she drew toward her last illness and his cousin, Zenobia Pierce, came over from the next valley to help him nurse her that human speech was heard again in the house. After the mortal silence of his long imprisonment, Zena's volubility was music in his ears. He felt that he might have gone like his mother if the sound of a new voice had not come to steady him. Zena seemed to understand his case at a glance. She laughed at him for not knowing the simplest sickbed duties and told him to go right along out and leave her to see to things. The mere fact of obeying her orders, of feeling free to go about his business again and talk with other men, restored his shaken balance and magnified his sense of what he owed her. Her efficiency shamed and dazzled him. She seemed to possess, by instinct, all the household wisdom that his long apprenticeship had not instilled in him. When the end came, it was she who had to tell him to hitch up and go for the undertaker, and she thought it funny that he had not settled beforehand who was to have his mother's clothes and the sewing machine. After the funeral, when he saw her preparing to go away, he was seized with an unreasoning dread of being left alone on the farm, and before he knew what he was doing, he had asked her to stay there with him. He had often thought since that it would not have happened if his mother had died in spring instead of winter. When they married, it was agreed that as soon as he could straighten out the difficulties resulting from Mrs. Frome's long illness, they would sell the farm and sawmill and try their luck in a large town. Ethan's love of nature did not take the form of a taste for agriculture. He had always wanted to be an engineer and to live in towns where there were lectures and big libraries and fellows doing things. A slight engineering job in Florida, put in his way during his period of study at Worcester, increased his faith in his ability as well as his eagerness to see the world, and he felt sure that, with a smart wife like Zena, it would not be long before he had made himself a place in it. Zena's native village was slightly larger and nearer to the railway than Starkfield, and she had let her husband see from the first that life on an isolated farm was not what she had expected when she married. But purchasers were slow in coming, and while he waited for them, Ethan learned the impossibility of transplanting her. She chose to look down on Starkfield, but she could not have lived in a place which looked down on her. Even Bettsbridge or Shad's Falls would not have been sufficiently aware of her, and in the greater cities which attracted Ethan she would have suffered a complete loss of identity. And within a year of their marriage she developed the sickliness which had since made her notable even in a community rich in pathological instances. When she came to take care of his mother she had seemed to Ethan like the very genius of health, but he soon saw that her skill as a nurse had been acquired by the absorbed observation of her own symptoms. Then she too fell silent. Perhaps it was the inevitable effect of life on the farm, or perhaps, as she sometimes said, it was because Ethan never listened. The charge was not wholly unfounded. When she spoke, it was only to complain, and to complain of things not in his power to remedy. And to check a tendency to impatient retort, he had first formed the habit of not answering her, and finally of thinking of other things while she talked. Of late, however, since he had had reasons for observing her more closely, her silence had begun to trouble him. He recalled his mother's growing taciturnity, and wondered if Zena were also turning queer. Women did, he knew. Zena, who had at her fingers' ends the pathological chart of the whole region, had cited many cases of the kind while she was nursing his mother.
and he himself knew of certain lonely farmhouses in the neighborhood where stricken creatures pined, and of others where sudden tragedy had come of their presence. At times, looking at Zena's shut face, he felt the chill of such forebodings. At other times, her silence seemed deliberately assumed to conceal far-reaching intentions, mysterious conclusions drawn from suspicions and resentments impossible to guess. That supposition was even more disturbing than the other, and it was the one which had come to him the night before, when he had seen her standing in the kitchen door. Now her departure for Bettsbridge had once more eased his mind, and all his thoughts were on the prospect of his evening with Mattie. Only one thing weighed on him, and that was his having told Zena that he was to receive cash for the lumber. He foresaw so clearly the consequences of this imprudence that with considerable reluctance he decided to ask Andrew Hale for a small advance on his load. When Ethan drove into Hale's yard, the builder was just getting out of his sleigh. "Hello, Eth," he said. "This comes handy." Andrew Hale was a ruddy man with a big gray mustache and a stubbly double chin unconstrained by a collar, but his scrupulously clean shirt was always fastened by a small diamond stud. This display of opulence was misleading, for though he did a fairly good business, it was known that his easy-going habits and the demands of his large family frequently kept him what Starkfield called behind. He was an old friend of Eth's family, and his house one of the few to which Zena occasionally went, drawn there by the fact that Mrs. Hale, in her youth, had done more doctoring than any other woman in Starkfield, and was still a recognized authority on symptoms and treatment. Hale went up to the Greys and patted their sweating flanks. "Well, sir," he said, "you keep them too as if they was pets." Ethan set about unloading the logs, and when he had finished his job, he pushed open the glazed door of the shed which the builder used as his office. Hale sat with his feet up on the stove, his back propped against a battered desk strewn with papers. The place, like the man, was warm, genial, and untidy. "Sit right down and thaw out," he greeted Ethan. The latter did not know how to begin, but at length he managed to bring out his request for an advance of $50. The blood rushed to his thin skin under the sting of Hale's astonishment. It was the builder's custom to pay at the end of 3 months, and there was no precedent between the two men for a cash settlement. Ethan felt that if he had pleaded an urgent need, Hale might have made shift to pay him, but pride and an instinctive prudence kept him from resorting to this argument. After his father's death, it had taken time to get his head above water, and he did not want Andrew Hale or anyone else in Starkfield to think he was going under again. Besides, he hated lying. If he wanted the money, he wanted it, and it was nobody's business to ask why. He therefore made his demand with the awkwardness of a proud man who will not admit to himself that he is stooping, and he was not much surprised at Hale's refusal. The builder refused genially, as he did everything else. He treated the matter as something in the nature of a practical joke, and wanted to know if Ethan meditated buying a grand piano or adding a cupolo to his house, offering, in the latter case, to give his services free of cost. Ethan's arts were soon exhausted, and after an embarrassed pause, he wished Hale good day and opened the door of the office. As he passed out, the builder suddenly called after him, "See here, you ain't in a tight place, are you?" "Not a bit," Ethan's pride retorted before his reason had time to intervene. "Well, that's good, because I am a shade. Fact is, I was going to ask you to give me a little extra time on that payment. Business is pretty slack to begin with, and then I'm fixing up a little house for Ned and Ruth when they're married. I'm glad to do it for 'em, but it costs." His look appealed to Ethan for sympathy. "The young people like things nice. You know how it is yourself. It's not so long ago since you fixed up your own place for Zena." Ethan left the Greys in Hale's stable and went about some other business in the village. As he walked away, the builder's last phrase lingered in his ears, and he reflected grimly that his 7 years with Zena seemed to Starkfield not so long. The afternoon was drawing to an end, and here and there a lighted pane spangled the cold gray dusk and made the snow look whiter. The bitter weather had driven everyone indoors, and Ethan had the long rural street to himself. Suddenly he heard the brisk play of sleigh bells, and a cutter passed him, drawn by a free-going horse. Ethan recognized Michael Eady's roan colt, and young Dennis Eady, in a handsome new fur cap, leaned forward and waved a greeting. "Hello, Eath," he shouted, and spun on. The cutter was going in the direction of the Frome farm, and Ethan's heart contracted as he listened to the dwindling bells. What was more likely than that Dennis Eady had heard of Zena's departure for Bettsbridge and was profiting by the opportunity to spend an hour with Maddie? Ethan was ashamed of the storm of jealousy in his breast. It seemed unworthy of the girl that his thoughts of her should be so violent. He walked on to the church corner and entered the shade of the Varnum spruces, where he had stood with her the night before. As he passed into their gloom, he saw an indistinct outline just ahead of him. At his approach, it melted for an instant into two separate shapes, and then conjoined again, and he heard a kiss and a half-laughing, "Oh!" provoked by the discovery of his presence. Again the outline hastily disunited, and the Varnum gate slammed on one half while the other hurried on ahead of him. Ethan smiled at the discomfiture he had caused. What did it matter to Ned Hale and Ruth Varnum if they were caught kissing each other? Everybody in Starkfield knew they were engaged. It pleased Ethan to have surprised a pair of lovers on the spot where he and Maddie had stood with such a thirst for each other in their hearts. But he felt a pang at the thought that these two need not hide their happiness. He fetched the grays from Hale's stable and started on his long climb back to the farm. The cold was less sharp than earlier in the day, and a thick fleecy sky threatened snow for the morrow. Here and there a star pricked through, showing behind it a deep well of blue. In an hour or two the moon would push over the ridge behind the farm, burn a gold-edged rent in the clouds, and then be swallowed by them. A mournful peace hung on the fields, as though they felt the relaxing grasp of the cold and stretched themselves in their long winter sleep. Ethan's ears were alert for the jingle of sleigh bells, but not a sound broke the silence of the lonely road. As he drew near the farm, he saw, through the thin screen of larches at the gate, a light twinkling in the house above him. "She's up in her room," he said to himself, "fixing herself up for supper." And he remembered Zena's sarcastic stare when Maddie, on the evening of her arrival, had come down to supper with smoothed hair and a ribbon at her neck. He passed by the graves on the knoll and turned his head to glance at one of the older headstones, which had interested him deeply as a boy because it bore his name. "Sacred to the memory of Ethan Frome and Endurance, his wife, who dwelled together in peace for 50 years. He used to think that 50 years sounded like a long time to live together, but now it seemed to him that they might pass in a flash. Then, with a sudden dart of irony, he wondered if, when their turn came, the same epitaph would be written over him and Zena. He opened the barn door and craned his head into the obscurity, half fearing to discover Dennis Eady's roan colt in the stall beside the sorrel. But the old horse was there alone, mumbling his crib with toothless jaws, and Ethan whistled cheerfully while he bedded down the grays and shook an extra measure of oats into their mangers. His was not a tuneful throat, but harsh melodies burst from it as he locked the barn and sprang up the hill to the house. He reached the kitchen porch and turned the door handle, but the door did not yield to his touch. Startled at finding it locked, he rattled the handle violently. Then he reflected that Maddie was alone and that it was natural she should barricade herself at nightfall. He stood in the darkness, expecting to hear her step. It did not come, and after vainly straining his ears, he called out in a voice that shook with joy, "Hello, Matt!" Silence answered.
But in a minute or two, he caught a sound on the stairs and saw a line of light about the door frame, as he had seen it the night before. So strange was the precision with which the incidents of the previous evening were repeating themselves that he half expected, when he heard the key turn, to see his wife before him on the threshold. But the door opened and Maddie faced him. She stood just as Zena had stood, a lifted lamp in her hand, against the back background of the kitchen. She held the light at the same level, and it drew out with the same distinctness her slim young throat and the brown wrist no bigger than a child's. Then, striking upward, it threw a lustrous fleck on her lips, edged her eyes with velvet shade, and laid a milky whiteness above the black curve of her brows. She wore her usual dress of darkish stuff, and there was no bow at her neck, but through her hair she had run a streak of crimson ribbon. This tribute to the unusual transformed and glorified her. She seemed to Ethan taller, fuller, more womanly in shape and motion. She stood aside, smiling silently while he entered, and then moved away from him with something soft and flowing in her gait. She set the lamp on the table, and he saw that it was carefully laid for supper, with fresh doughnuts, stewed blueberries, and his favorite pickles in a dish of gay red glass. A bright fire glowed in the stove, and the cat lay stretched before it, watching the table with a drowsy eye. Ethan was suffocated with a sense of well-being. He went into the passage to hang up his coat and pull off his wet boots. When he came back, Maddie had set the teapot on the table, and the cat was rubbing itself persuasively against her ankles. "Why, puss, I nearly tripped over you," she cried, the laughter sparkling through her lashes. Again Ethan felt a sudden twinge of jealousy. Could it be his coming that gave her such a kindled face? "Well, Matt, any visitors?" he threw off, stooping down carelessly to examine the fastening of the stove. She nodded and laughed. "Yes, one." And he felt a blackness settling on his brows. "Who was that?" he questioned, raising himself up to slant a glance at her beneath his scowl. Her eyes danced with malice. "Why, Jotham Powell. He came in after he got back and asked for a drop of coffee before he went down home." The blackness lifted, and light flooded Ethan's brain. "That all? Well, I hope you made out to let him have it." And after a pause, he felt it right to add, "I suppose he got Zena over to the flats all right?"
"Oh, yes, in plenty of time."
The name threw a chill between them, and they stood a moment looking sideways at each other before Maddie said with a shy laugh, "I guess it's about time for supper." They drew their seats up to the table, and the cat, unbidden, jumped between them into Zena's empty chair. "Oh, puss," said Maddie, and they laughed again. Ethan, a moment earlier, had felt himself on the brink of eloquence, but the mention of Zena had paralyzed him. Maddie seemed to feel the contagion of his embarrassment and sat with downcast lids, sipping her tea, while he feigned an insatiable appetite for doughnuts and sweet pickles. At last, after casting about for an effective opening, he took a long gulp of tea, cleared his throat, and said, "Looks as if there'd be more snow." She feigned great interest.
"Is that so? Do you suppose it'll interfere with Zena's getting back?"
She flushed red as the question escaped her and hastily set down the cup she was lifting. Ethan reached over for another helping of pickles. "You never can tell this time of year. It drifts so bad on the flats." The name had benumbed him again, and once more he felt as if Zena were in the room between them.
"Oh, puss, you're too greedy," Maddie cried.
The cat, unnoticed, had crept up on muffled paws from Zena's seat to the table and was stealthily elongating its body in the direction of the milk jug, which stood between Ethan and Maddie. The two leaned forward at the same moment, and their hands met on the handle of the jug. Maddie's hand was underneath, and Ethan kept his clasped on it a moment longer than was necessary.
The cat, profiting by this unusual demonstration, tried to effect an unnoticed retreat, and in doing so backed into the pickle dish, which fell to the floor with a crash. Maddie in an instant had sprung from her chair and was down on her knees by the fragments.
"Oh, Ethan! Ethan, it's all to pieces! What will Zena say?"
But this time his courage was up. "Well, she'll have to say it to the cat anyway," he rejoined with a laugh, kneeling down at Maddie's side to scrape up the swimming pickles. She lifted stricken eyes to him.
"Yes, but you see, she never meant it to be used, not even when there was company, and I had to get up on the stepladder to reach it down from the top shelf of the china closet, where she keeps it with all her best things, and of course she'll want to know why I did it."
The case was so serious that it called forth all of Ethan's latent resolution. "She needn't know anything about it if you keep quiet. I'll get another just like it tomorrow. Where did it come from? I'll go to Shad's Falls for it if I have to."
"Oh, you'll never get another even there. It was a wedding present, don't you remember? It came all the way from Philadelphia, from Zena's aunt that married the minister. That's why she wouldn't ever use it. Oh, Ethan, Ethan, what in the world shall I do?"
She began to cry, and he felt as if every one of her tears were pouring over him like burning lead.
"Don't, Matt, don't. Oh, don't," he implored her.
She struggled to her feet, and he rose and followed her helplessly while she spread out the pieces of glass on the kitchen dresser. It seemed to him as if the shattered fragments of their evening lay there.
"Here, give them to me," he said, in a voice of sudden authority.
She drew aside, instinctively obeying his tone.
"Oh, Ethan, what are you going to do?"
Without replying, he gathered the pieces of glass into his broad palm and walked out of the kitchen to the passage. There he lit a candle end, opened the china closet, and, reaching his long arm up to the highest shelf, laid the pieces together with such accuracy of touch that a close inspection convinced him of the impossibility of detecting from below that the dish was broken. If he glued it together the next morning, months might elapse before his wife noticed what had happened, and meanwhile he might after all be able to match the dish at Shad's Falls or Bettsbridge. Having satisfied himself that there was no risk of immediate discovery, he went back to the kitchen with a lighter step and found Maddie disconsolately removing the last scraps of pickle from the floor.
"It's all right, Matt. Come back and finish supper," he commanded her.
Completely reassured, she shone on him through tear-hung lashes, and his soul swelled with pride as he saw how his tone subdued her. She did not even ask what he had done. Except when he was steering a big log down the mountain to his mill, he had never known such a thrilling sense of mastery. Chapter 5. They finished supper, and while Maddie cleared the table, Ethan went to look at the cows, and then took a last turn about the house. The earth lay dark under a muffled sky, and the air was so still that now and then he heard a lump of snow come thumping down from a tree far off on the edge of the woodlot. When he returned to the kitchen, Maddie had pushed up his chair to the stove and seated herself near the lamp with a bit of sewing. The scene was just as he had dreamed of it that morning. He sat down, drew his pipe from his pocket, and stretched his feet to the glow. His hard day's work in the keen air made him feel at once lazy and light of mood, and he had a confused sense of being in another world where all was warmth and harmony and time could bring no change. The only drawback to his complete well-being was the fact that he could not see Maddie from where he sat, but he was too indolent to move, and after a moment he said, "Come over here and sit by the stove." Zena's empty rocking chair stood facing him. Maddie rose obediently and seated herself in it. As her young brown head detached itself against the patchwork cushion that habitually framed his wife's gaunt countenance, Ethan had a momentary shock. It was almost as if the other face, the face of the superseded woman, had obliterated that of the intruder. After a moment, Maddie seemed to be affected by the same sense of constraint. She changed her position, leaning forward to bend her head above her work so that he saw only the foreshortened tip of her nose and the streak of red in her hair. Then she slipped to her feet, saying, "I can't see to sew," and went back to her chair by the lamp. Ethan made a pretext of getting up to replenish the stove, and when he returned to his seat, he pushed it sideways that he might get a view of her profile and of the lamplight falling on her hands. The cat, who had been a puzzled observer of these unusual movements, jumped up into Zena's chair, rolled itself into a ball, and lay watching them with narrowed eyes. Deep quiet sank on the room. The clock ticked above the dresser. A piece of charred wood fell now and then in the stove, and the sharp, faint scent of the geraniums mingled with the odor of Ethan's smoke, which began to throw a bluish haze about the lamp and to hang its grayish cobwebs in the shadowy corners of the room. All constraint had vanished between the two, and they began to talk easily and simply. They spoke of everyday things, of the prospect of snow, of the next church sociable, of the loves and quarrels of Starkfield. The commonplace nature of what they said produced in Ethan an illusion of long-established intimacy which no outburst of emotion could have given, and he set his imagination adrift on the fiction that they had always spent their evenings thus and would always go on doing so. "This is the night we were to have gone coasting, Matt," he said at length, with the rich sense, as he spoke, that they could go on any other night they chose, since they had all time before them. She smiled back at him. "I guess you forgot." "No, I didn't forget, but it's as dark as Egypt outdoors. We might go tomorrow, if there's a moon." She laughed with pleasure, her head tilted back, the lamplight sparkling on her lips and teeth.
"That would be lovely, Ethan."
He kept his eyes fixed on her, marveling at the way her face changed with each turn of their talk, like a wheat field under a summer breeze. It was intoxicating to find such magic in his clumsy words, and he longed to try new ways of using it.
"Would you be scared to go down the Corbury Road with me on a night like this?" he asked.
Her cheeks burned redder.
"I ain't any more scared than you are." "Well, I'd be scared then. I wouldn't do it. That's an ugly corner down by the big elm. If a fella didn't keep his eyes open, he'd go plumb into it."
He luxuriated in the sense of protection and authority which his words conveyed. To prolong and intensify the feeling, he added, "I guess we're well enough here." She let her lids sink slowly, in the way he loved. "Yes, we're well enough here," she sighed. Her tone was so sweet that he took the pipe from his mouth and drew his chair up to the table. Leaning forward, he touched the farther end of the strip of brown stuff that she was hemming.
"Say, Matt," he began with a smile, "what do you think I saw under the Varnum spruces coming along home just now? I saw a friend of yours getting kissed."
The words had been on his tongue all the evening, but now that he had spoken them, they struck him as inexpressibly vulgar and out of place. Maddie blushed to the roots of her hair and pulled her needle rapidly, twice or thrice through her work, insensibly drawing the end of it away from him. "I suppose it was Ruth and Ned," she said in a low voice, as though he had suddenly touched on something grave. Ethan had imagined that his allusion might open the way to the accepted pleasantries, and these perhaps in turn to a harmless caress, if only a mere touch on her hand. But now he felt as if her blush had set a flaming guard about her. He supposed it was his natural awkwardness that made him feel so. He knew that most young men made nothing at all of giving a pretty girl a kiss, and he remembered that the night before, when he had put his arm about Maddie, she had not resisted. But that had been out of doors, under the open, irresponsible night. Now, in the warm, lamplit room, with all its ancient implications of conformity and order, she seemed infinitely farther away from him and more unapproachable.
To ease his constraint, he said, I suppose they'll be setting a date before long.
Yes. I shouldn't wonder if they got married sometime along in the summer.
She pronounced the word married as if her voice caressed it. It seemed a rustling covert leading to enchanted glades. A pang shot through Ethan, and he said, twisting away from her in his chair,
It'll be your turn next, I wouldn't wonder.
She laughed a little uncertainly.
Why do you keep on saying that?
He echoed her laugh. I guess I do it to get used to the idea.
He drew up to the table again, and she sewed on in silence, with dropped lashes, while he sat in fascinated contemplation of the way in which her hands went up and down above the strip of stuff, just as he had seen a pair of birds make short, perpendicular flights over a nest they were building. At length, without turning her head or lifting her lids, she said in a low tone,
It's not because you think Xena's got anything against me, is it?
His former dread started up full-armed at the suggestion.
Why? What do you mean? He stammered.
She raised distressed eyes to his, her work dropping on the table between them.
I don't know. I thought last night she seemed to have.
I'd like to know what, he growled.
Nobody can tell with Xena.
It was the first time they had ever spoken so openly of her attitude toward Maddie, and the repetition of the name seemed to carry it to the farther corners of the room and send it back to them in long repercussions of sound. Maddie waited, as if to give the echo time to drop, and then went on,
She hasn't said anything to you?
He shook his head.
No, not a word.
She tossed the hair back from her forehead with a laugh.
I guess I'm just nervous, then. I'm not going to think about it anymore.
Oh, no. Don't let's think about it, Matt.
The sudden heat of his tone made her color mount again, not with a rush, but gradually, delicately, like the reflection of a thought stealing slowly across her heart. She sat silent, her hands clasped on her work, and it seemed to him that a warm current flowed toward him along the strip of stuff that lay still unrolled between them. Cautiously, he slid his hand palm downward along the table till his fingertips touched the end of the stuff. A faint vibration of her lashes seemed to show that she was aware of his gesture and that it had sent a counter-current back to her. And she let her hands lie motionless on the other side of the strip. As they sat thus, he heard a sound behind him and turned his head. The cat had jumped from Xena's chair to dart at a mouse in the wainscot, and as a result of the sudden movement, the empty chair had set up a spectral rocking.
She'll be rocking in it herself this time tomorrow, thought Ethan. I've been in a dream. And this is the only evening we'll ever have together.
The return to reality was as painful as the return to consciousness after taking an anesthetic. His body and brain ached with indescribable weariness, and he could think of nothing to say or to do that should arrest the mad flight of the moments. His alteration of mood seemed to have communicated itself to Maddie. She looked up at him languidly, as though her lids were weighted with sleep. And it cost her an effort to raise them. Her glance fell on his hand, which now completely covered the end of her work, and grasped it as if it were a part of herself. He saw a scarcely perceptible tremor cross her face, and without knowing what he did, he stooped his head and kissed the bit of stuff in his hold. As his lips rested on it, he felt it glide slowly from beneath them, and saw that Maddie had risen and was silently rolling up her work. She fastened it with a pin, and then, finding her thimble and scissors, put them with the roll of stuff into the box covered with fancy paper which he had once brought to her from Bettsbridge. He stood up also, looking vaguely about the room. The clock above the dresser struck 11.
"Is the fire all right?" she asked in a low voice.
He opened the door of the stove and poked aimlessly at the embers. When he raised himself again, he saw that she was dragging toward the stove the old soapbox lined with carpet in which the cat made its bed. Then she recrossed the floor and lifted two of the geranium pots in her arms, moving them away from the cold window. He followed her and brought the other geraniums, the hyacinth bulbs in a cracked custard bowl, and the German ivy trained over an old croquet hoop. When these nightly duties were performed, there was nothing left to do but to bring in the tin candlestick from the passage, light the candle, and blow out the lamp. Ethan put the candlestick in Maddie's hand, and she went out of the kitchen ahead of him, the light that she carried before her making her dark hair look like a drift of mist on the moon. "Good night, Matt," he said as she put her foot on the first step of the stairs. She turned and looked at him a moment. "Good night, Ethan," she answered, and went up. When the door of her room had closed on her, he remembered that he had not even touched her hand.